Hello and welcome to Shashin, a conversation about Japanese photography. I'm Giovanni, your host, and we are podcasting from Tokyo. This podcast is hosted by fangoradio.com, and I'd like to take this time to thank them for the opportunity. I already have another show on fangoradio.com called HATFCR. It's a monthly selection of electronic, experimental, and future hip-hop music. In this second episode, we will talk about Daido Moriyama. I will introduce Alberto Ferrero as a co-host of the podcast. We had so much fun talking together last time that we decided to make a fixed thing. And then I will interview Sean Lottman, Kyoto-based American photographer, who also was the other guest on the Influences Zine among Alberto. Both chat with Alberto and Sean went longer than I expect. We had so much to talk. So I decided to split these episodes in two parts because I couldn't fit in the 1 hour format. So today is going to be Daido Moriyama, Alberto and Sean part one. And then the next month I will publish the second and final part. Last episode I realized that maybe I was nervous or I was feeling excited for the release of the first episode. With Alberto, we were talking about this zine Influences, but I never explained what is this project. So basically, Influences is the first printed publication of Zero Feedback. And Zero Feedback, it was when it born in 2007, was a video label, and now I transform into a publishing house. And Influences is the first project that I'm releasing, and we are now releasing number four. And basically Influences is a series of publication inspired by the game The Exquisite Corpse that wanna connect two photographers who sequentially will influence each other for the completion of each publication. Basically the process work like this. One of the two photographers will start posting a photo, and then the other photographer need to answer to that photo to another photo from his archive, or he will shoot a new one, that doesn't matter. And the important thing is that there must be a connection with the previous photo. Can be aesthetically, formally, conceptually, that doesn't matter. The important thing is that there has to be a connection. And then when the two photographers will reach 10 photos each, that is the end of them publication. For the first series, I will publish 12 numbers, and that will sign the end of this experiment. And if this will generate enough interest, I will keep doing 12 numbers by 12 numbers. So it is basically an endless project, because at the end is like two photographers interacting with each other. So, and there is a endless photographer around the world. So I hope this is gonna be interesting. So this podcast was born also to, of course, advertise the project, but mostly to speak with a photographer who participate or will participate to the project and talk about them work primarily, and then the experience of what was the experience of doing these Influences. So let's start talking about Daido Moriyama. Daido Moriyama bought in 1938 in Osaka, Japan, and is one of the most known Japanese photographer, and he's well known for his radical approach to both medium and subject. Daido Moriyama's unique and gritty aesthetic is why he's known as one of the master photographers of the 20th century. His grimy, captivating and brutal images of Tokyo's dark underbelly portray a whole country's socio-political state. In 1972, Daido Moriyama published a book called Shashin Yo Sayonara that can be translated into English as Farewell Photography. Enigmatic and seemingly innocuous, the title actually summarized an entire revolutionary photographic upheaval. Contrary to what his fellow American and European photographers were doing with their well-composed, beautiful tone and elegiac pictures, Daido Moriyama started experimenting with an anti-photographic style. His blurry, grainy, out-of-focus, starkly constructed picture, often unbalanced and even casually framed, were a laugh in the face of what was then traditionally considered a good photograph. Clarity isn't what photography is about, Moriyama object. Moriyama's career began in 1961 when he moved to Tokyo to join the legendary Vivo group of photographers, which however dissolved only a short while later. The role of Japan's capital city in Moriyama's work is far-reaching. Post-Second World War, Tokyo and Japan more generally experienced a phenomenal economic growth, which vastly impacted the city in every way. In particular, the strong urbanization caused Tokyo's street life to boom, and Daido Moriyama, then in his 20s, was irresistibly drawn to it. One of Daido Moriyama's major influences was the work of American photographer William Klein. Between 1956 and 1960s, Klein published four photography books, each dedicated to the street life of international capital: New York, Rome, Moscow, and Tokyo. The street scene captured in Klein's picture, in particular those in New York, a book that turned out to be highly influential, inspired Moriyama to go out and take more and more photographs. I was so touched and provoked by Klein's photo book that I spent all my time on the street of Shinjuku, mixing myself in with the noise and the crowds, doing nothing except clicking with abandon the shutter of the camera. While Klein's images are energetic and all about the fun, Moriyama's early work depicts Tokyo's lowest life and have a mysterious, gritty, at times erotic feeling attached to them. His first photography book, Japan, a Photo Theater, presented a series of pictures taken by Moriyama in 1968 in the most infamous entertainment venues in Tokyo, nightclub where artists and prostitutes and Yakuza gangsters were brought together by sex and alcohol. Once again, the title sets the tone. The streets of boom in Tokyo are, in Daido Moriyama's onivorous eyes, a lovely unstaged theater ready to be photographed at every turn. Still, in the 1960s, Moriyama was part of a group of left-wing photographers who were critical of Japan's post-war westernization, or better yet, Americanization. In several of his images, for example, Moriyama photographed raw, packed with American product on the shelf of Tokyo's supermarket. What these photographers had in common was the use of a style that intentionally broke away from the style that was conventionally accepted at the time by the photographic intelligentsia and was identified with the expression are bure bokeh, grainy, blurry and out of focus, in reference of the three main characteristics that distinguish the group's images. In doing so, they translate their dissatisfaction or agitation with the rapid change of the Japanese society to a visual level. However, the protest was also exquisitely artistic and questioned the conception of photography altogether, refusing the idea that the photographic medium could only be used to produce archival documents. Through a radicalization of style, these photographers were putting an accent on its image-making capability. The are bure bokeh aesthetic was cemented and turned into a legend through Provoke, a photography magazine of only three issues, publishing between 1968 and 1969, which, however, made the history of photography for the radical photographic content found on its pages. Not coincidentally, the magazine subtitle read Provocative Documents for the Sake of Thought. Although Moriyama was not among Provoke's founder and only contributed to the second and third issues, he remained the most memorable and influential of the photographers who participated in that experience. But he didn't stop at Provoke. Over the years following the magazine's last issue, he brought the dramatization of the Arebure bokeh style to the extreme, and more specifically to the point that his street photograph became almost completely abstract and illegible. In 1972, the aforementioned flower photography was published. Daido Moriyama's mission was achieved. Photography had been destroyed. After the publication of flower photography, Moriyama returned to more classic aesthetic while retaining a tendency toward abstraction. Among the most successful series made later in his career in the 1987 Tides, updated with the new work in 2012, the series comprises close-up photographs of women's legs in fishnet tights. Indeed, the lens is so close to the subject that it is difficult to identify the lines of the leg, making the image from tights a pure visual study in form and texture, but with an undeniable erotic subtext. Moriyama's influence on subsequent generation of street photography is paramount. Although he owes much to William Klein, his beloved dark, grainy aesthetic has become a signature of Japanese photography by way of his prolific production and numerous photographic books. In one of Moriyama's photographs, associated more than any other with his name, Stray Dog, the eponymous stray dog turns its head to the camera. Like the dog, Moriyama has searched Tokyo street for visual nourishment, and it comes as no surprise that another important influence was not a photographer but writer Jack Kerouac, the author of On the Road. Both Moriyama and Kerouac, although with different mediums, put the journey at the center of their work. Wandering was their way to explore the world. Convinced along with the Provoke photographer that anything can be made into an image, Moriyama never cared for what the French master Enrique Tiburcon defined as the decisive moment. His approach to photography always had pure vision at its roots. For me, photographs are taken in the eye before you even thought what they mean. That's the reality I'm interested in capturing. This so potently shines through Moriyama's body of work, a collection of images carved out of Tokyo Street's life that is mostly insignificant in terms of narrative content, but incredibly suggestive on the emotional side. Much like a superhero of the photography art, while out in the street, Moriyama seemed compelled to click the shutter with a heightened sense of vision, over and over again, relentlessly and indistinctively, moved to action by the fragment of the tragic beauty found in Tokyo Dark's underbelly. Now, because what I was thinking today, while I was preparing today's episode with Daido, and also I was thinking about Hiroshi Tsujimoto, they are such two different photographers. I am more close to Daido because the underdog is something that fascinates me.
Yeah.
And Hiroshi Tsujimoto sounds like he had a Mamiya 6x6. Sounds like a privileged boy.
Yeah, it's pretty two different worlds.
And I don't have usually much sympathy for the privileged boys. But it also, he possesses a deepness. I like what he's thinking. Well, I feel that is more an instinctive person, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, what impressed me is that people still do what he actually did decades ago. So he basically took a camera and treated it as a toy, and without thinking about photography, just playing with it and taking pictures of his garden, and it just made this thing that still people buy these small cameras and still do the same thing. So it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I agree, and especially look like that he did it when he no one was doing it, at least in Japan.
Yeah. So yeah, because I guess, you know, like decades ago, you know, photography was, you know, the role of photographers was really like strict. There was not people doing crazy things, I think. I don't know, I'm not so wise about it. But I think when you were saying, okay, I'm a photographer, so you had to really, you had probably some rules, and the machines were the machines that you had, and you need to do some certain kind of photography. So when a person just took a camera probably and just used it as a toy without thinking about the rules of photography, just, you know, doing what he liked to do, like just playing with it, yeah, it was different. Now it's more like a normal thing.
Yeah, yeah, true. But exactly what you're saying is like how many people has been clearly inspired for the work of Moriyama. It's impressive. There is so many, like these really deep contrast, black and white, sweet photography. But what is interesting for me when I watched that documentary, that he was talking about the difference from a point and shoot camera from the DSLR, how that affect the person shooting on the street especially, and how he was saying, yeah, the point and shoot is less intimidating, so the people is kind of not affected by it. And I was just to another exhibition 1 month ago in Tokyo about Seto Masato, that is actually the photographer who ran the place M with Daide Moriyama. And there's a series where he shoot this guy, no, this couple at the picnic. And he say he tried one time going with the SLR, and everyone said, no, I don't want you to take photos of me. And then he back with a 4x5, and everyone want the photos.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because they thought, oh, you're a professional photographer, so yes, I want the photo. And I, they say completely the opposite. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah, I think also because they, you know, they knew that they were getting photographed, I think, in this case. So, you know, he was a photographer and just, he was asking people, can I take a photo of you? And they were seeing him probably with a small camera and saying, no, what the fuck are you doing with that? And then it was like, then showing up with a big one and saying, oh, okay, now I want a photo. But yeah, but super interesting. Yeah, it's totally. It also depends, right? I mean, what I personally felt in general in Tokyo, I mean, I also don't care too much about cameras, but I really felt that the Leica that I used there really made possible the kind of photos that I took, because I was not focusing, and it was really quick to frame and to just shoot, and people didn't even realize what I was doing. So same attitude with with a point and shoot small camera, but still, you know, like a, it's not a big camera, but it's bigger.
Yeah, but it's quieter. It's not loud camera.
It's very quiet. Yeah.
And you was using zone focusing. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I was pushing the HP 5 to to stop. So, you know, and also in the night with the flash, so it was always very, very close to the aperture, so very easy to focus. Yeah. Nice memory. They're coming back to my mind.
Yeah, but like actually, I think 1 year ago I bought the Olympus XA. It's like, it's a really small camera in my hand. It's actually disappear. And I noticed how I approach the photography. It's so I'm much more kind of like I go in the face of the people. They usually, I don't have a courage of doing with a, as he was saying, if I need to put the camera on my eyes and frame, I will not maybe take as many pictures as I do with the XA. So,
And what do you think, a good or a bad thing? What do you think about the photos that you take with the small camera? Because before you answer. Mm. I also sometimes, you know, I bought a Ricoh GR2, I think the digital one, and I was like, oh my God, now I'm taking so many photos and face people, whatever. I'm like, I'm invisible right now. But I ended up like being very miserable with the photos that I actually got, because it was too much. It was too easy, right? So it was I had too many photos, and of course I ended up with something that I liked, but I was not happy. I really ended up miserable. So I think the Leica was for me like a sort of like a balance between doing it very easily, but not too much. So what is your experience?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So far, I'm happy of the photo I'm getting. I'm shooting a little bit over what I would like as a number of shots. But yeah, I prefer a different experience. So I prefer when I frame. I'm not entirely, because I'm not in control of what I'm doing, and I'm not such an experienced photographer that I can be in control. So it's so random. I don't know how much I'm happy about that. I like my attitude, but at the same time, it's not an easy experience. And I was thinking, I also have a medium format Fuji, the one with the bellow. And I love the camera. The photo is so nice, super sharp, but every photo is shitty, man.
Every photo is what?
Shit. I don't like any of the photo I took with that camera. It's crazy.
Why?
I don't know. I'm so unsatisfied. So
you're taking too much time for each photo.
Probably. I feel it's precious, so it's like, okay, so I don't know, but I'm totally unsatisfied. But I never tried the Leica, so I don't know.
Like butter.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, but it also depends like where you are, right? I mean, in Tokyo, if I would be back in Tokyo, and I hope soon, I would actually take my Leica back. And not using it too much. I'm actually using it now for, I don't know, it snowed like some days ago here in Berlin, and I was like going out and shoot a lot with the Leica. But if I would not shoot here too much with the Leica. I don't know, it's a different approach, different country. It's really, I don't know, it's really a different approach. But in Tokyo, I would totally just bring that and just use that.
But do you think that is because Berlin is your hometown now and you feel more, less exotic, let's say, or because for me, in here I shoot a lot, but when I go back to Italy, zero. I have no impulse.
Yeah, I actually, when I go back to Italy, I shoot, but a different matter. The first days I shoot a lot because of course it's a new impulses, new inputs. So I'm like so super excited. I'm just shoot, and then I shoot people that talk my language. So I feel more easy on that.
Yeah.
And then I ended up to shoot my nephews and niece a lot. They're super funny, you know, they have chickens and stuff, so it's pretty nice. But I forgot the question. What was it?
Yeah, me too. It was the, I asked you if you shoot more or you feel to shoot more in Tokyo because it's more, let's say, exotic and Berlin is more familiar.
Is that a factor or not? I think it's people are just nicer in Tokyo. It's probably is a safe thing that we were talking in another episode, but I don't know. But I feel that it's like there's this connection with the people in the streets, and Berlin is like everybody is looking super grumpy, and you don't really want to shoot them. They're not nice to shoot. I enjoy to shoot when there are demonstrations or like festivals or the carnivals and stuff like that people are like they expect that and they're already in a good mood, but it's it's probably this thing, because in Tokyo, whatever person I was meeting, probably two or three people, they just said to me, fuck off. But I still got their picture, of course. But all the rest, I think they were like, even say thanks or just start talking to me and asking me what I was doing. And, you know, super nice. Nobody tried to slap at me, apart from that time that we met each other. Another story. He was not even Japanese, so fine. Anyway.
So what was your favorite place to shoot in Tokyo? Because we know Daido is Shinjuku and Kabukicho. Since we are talking about slap in the face.
Well, I had... I don't know. So there's two different kind of shooting, right? So the places where you got best pictures and the place where you actually had more fun, because it's not always related, the two things. They not always walk together along. So, of course, the place where I had more fun is probably Shibuya. Oh my God, like crazy. And the place where I got more pictures, I think that there's not like a certain place where I got best picture, but I really enjoy to be in Shinjuku also because it gives me a little bit more like of adrenaline, because of course it's more sketchy places. And the people were more like, you know, different, and Shibuya is more like young people going around. But yeah, probably Shibuya, Kabukicho. But I also liked a lot to go in the parks and shoot at nothing, just nature, and sometimes find a person and just shoot and try to take something interesting out of it.
Yeah, it's true. Kabukicho, it's a source of weird people. Maybe the weirdest place in Tokyo, probably. But I cannot imagine, like, when Daido was shooting in the 70s, what was that place?
Yeah. What actually was? Because I don't know. I've been in Japan in 2016, the first time, and I read the book about... it was... what was the name of this guy? Actually, from Florence. Maraini.
Dasha. Not Dasha.
The father. So he went to Japan in the 80s, I think, and it was very... It's called Leore, the book. It's very interesting, and it's actually picturing like Japanese society when actually nobody was going there as a tourist, right? I mean, in the 80s. So everybody, all Japanese, were looking at him like, oh my God, a foreigner, you know, who are you? Where, you know, what's your name? What are you doing? So I can't really picture now myself like doing the same things in Tokyo, or, you know, it would be just totally different situation. So interesting it would be.
I think so. I watched recently a documentary, I think shot in the 80s in Shinjuku, and it's called Shinjuku Boys, and it's a documentary about this host club that is run basically, the guys are not guys but a girl transvestite by boys. Now I don't know the exact classification, but the documentary is about the girls who work in this club, and it's shot in Kabukicho. Looks so different. Looks so deep, like I don't even know how to put a finger on it, but yeah, it would like look like it would be a super interesting place where to be, man.
Yeah, so just wanted to say the correct name. I looked it up. It's Fosco Maraini, and the book is Ore Giapponesi.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. A friend of mine gave it to me before I went to Japan, and, you know, just to have a, you know, just to know a little bit more how it was. Thank you.
let's talk now with Sean Lottman. How about you? What's your story?
I came here first when I was 27. Mm. And I was here for a couple of years, but I was leaving a lot, going to, mm-hmm. I was spending time in India and Sri Lanka, Southeast mm-hmm. Asia. And then I was done with Japan. I'm going to move back to the States. And I planned this like long trip, a 9-month trip across the Africa and the Middle East to get mm-hmm. back. And the month I was going to leave, I met the woman who would become my wife, and I invited mm-hmm. her on to meet me in Africa, and she said, oh, let's do it. And we knew each other 7 days, but you know, like together we had 7 days
okay
in each other's presence. And then I left for Jordan, and then I was there in the Middle East for 2.5 months, and then she flew to Kenya, and we wow. traveled Africa for 3 months overland all the way down to South Africa from Kenya, Uganda.
Wow.
And then 4 or 5 months later, I moved to Tokyo with her, and mm. we lived in Tokyo for about 5 years. Mm. And then Kyoto, we moved to at the end of 2011. Mm. So, yeah, 10 years in Kyoto. When did you move to Tokyo? What was like right around March 11th, or?
Yeah, after 3 months after that, 2 months after that.
Okay, so like May, around May.
Yeah.
2011. Those were like my last days living in Tokyo, and that was a pretty intense time.
Yeah, it was.
There were aftershocks like almost every day, and the radiation, and nobody knew what the real story was. Yeah. No one trusted the government. Yeah. I remember like hanging out with friends in the park, and like storm clouds would gather, and everyone would be like, let's get out of here, because we were all worried about radiation levels in the weather because of the fallout from Fukushima drifting down to the Kanto region. It was really intense. I met Araki in Shinjuku Gyoen around that time, and he was like, what are you doing here?
Yeah,
like he couldn't talk much because of his cancer. He's a fighter. He's still alive because he seemed in pretty bad shape when I met him, but he was just like, you know, it's really bad here with the with Fukushima, and I mean there were not many foreigners left in.
No, there was any.
Yeah, there was no tourism. I mean, understandably so. Mm. It was quite like it is now. With
it was. You know,
yeah.
How is it Kyoto now without any tourists?
I mean, like, it's strange. It's like, it's really, it's quiet. Like, if you want to go to Kinkakuji or Fushimi Inari or Kiyomizu-dera, like these blockbuster temples that are packed with buses and selfie sticks and just really just hordes of tourists. You can get it like an authentic experience again. Mm. So it's really amazing for, you know, anybody who lives in Japan to visit Kyoto, because it's like visiting Kyoto maybe in like it was in the 70s or something.
Yeah.
So it's just, there's no, without tourism, like the city is kind of regained its space.
Yeah.
But of course, everybody associated with the business of tourism has had a tough year financially, whether it's like hotels, guest houses, restaurants, tour guides, you know, just about, you know, it's like I'm sure the same in Italy.
Yeah.
Like you guys, Firenze is very much, I feel like, a tourist economy, Venice.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
These guest houses and hotels are just, and restaurants are just like struggling.
Yeah, I don't know how they are doing right now.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I have to say, I miss having the chance to be in Firenze right now.
Yeah.
Because I would experience that kind of atmosphere that I never experienced in my life, because for me, the city center of Firenze is packed of tourists all the time.
Always. Yeah.
So, but yeah, I don't think it's the best time to travel right now.
No, I haven't. I got back right from Europe right before the pandemic started, and we've taken local trips around the region, Yogo and Kansai area, but otherwise nothing, you know. So yeah, I love traveling. I mean, I love, I'm a traveler, and so just this kind of being stuck in one place is tough. I'm also like I'm quite cautious. I take this kind of stuff seriously with like viruses, and I had pneumonia in Africa, so I know what it's like to struggle with like your breathing when you've got a nasty infection in your lungs, and it's just not something like I want to repeat. So yeah, it's a lot of on the plus note, like my cooking skills have just gone so much better. I'm not worried about grocery stores, so I'm going to the grocery store almost every day and just gathering ingredients and trying stuff. So
yeah, my bread skill also is like going through the roof. I never cook anything, actually, and now I'm baking like crazy.
Oh, are you baking? You have a nice oven then?
Not much, but we adapt.
Yeah.
And then she cook well, so I just do the fancy stuff.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, being Italian, I'm sure there's expectations, right?
Yeah, but I'm not. I was going to ask you, actually, I understand from your photos that you travel a lot. So how you deal with this? Now it's more than 1 year now.
With the what?
How do you deal with the fact that you cannot travel? Because I guess that is a source of...
It's hard. I mean, also, to be honest, like, actually, I am in the tourist business. I run a guest house.
Oh, my God.
So, myself. So, I've seen, like, my own income just plunge. But fortunately, it's like, it's a small business. So, it's not like I've got, like, a bunch of places. Like, I'm sure, like, I know a lot of Japanese I've been reading about, like, they mortgaged they got like 6 mortgages, you know, because they thought the Olympics were going to happen, and it seemed like the tourism was just gathering momentum. It's been tough for me with that. I mean, I'm okay. I'm just I'm just not spending much money except for like ingredients and such. But like not traveling, it's tough. And I will have to travel maybe this year. I might. I mean, I have 2 books coming out. So one is in Tokyo and one is in Paris. And I'm not sure where the book in Paris is going to be printed. I've been talking to the publisher and designer. But like they normally print in Europe. But we've been talking about maybe printing in Japan. Although, you know, we still have, I mean, it's very early in the stages right now. We're printing in the summer, and I might have a show in we're still waiting for confirmation, but a show in California. So I would want to be in that, be there for that show. If I can. You know, like, I don't think I will be vaccinated in Japan before the summer. You know, it's pretty slow. No. So I'm wondering if I can get it done in the States when I go to visit. So, yeah, right now I'm just kind of mellow, but like soon I'm going to be having to make these kind of difficult decisions about travel. And I'm not excited about it. I mean, traveling is a joy, but like with all the precautions you have to take, and I just, when people are not careful, I do tend to lose my temper a bit. I mean, I don't want to, but like there's prudent behavior, and there's like, you know, there's kind of like, I don't know, thoughtless behavior. So I mean, it's tough, man. I'm trying to instill in my son a sense of travel and the pleasures and that. And we were doing that, you know, the first 5 years of his life. And he's been stuck at, you know, in Kyoto. Yeah. He doesn't really complain about it because he's got his toys and such. But, I really want him to... I hope humanity gets our act together, and we, you know, like my son, when he's 20, 21 years old, like the borders are open, and we, you know, it's safe, and he can have the adventures that I've had, and you know, my dream is to go to Europe with him when he's a teenager and hike the Alps for a month, you know, walking the trails and staying at different refuges on the way, and, you know, building, you know, instilling him this kind of love of travel that I didn't get from my parents. I had to.
Okay, yeah. So I was going to ask you, how do you get into the travel?
I don't know. It's like this kind of loop, like genetic mutation. Both my sister and I, my sister too, she moved to France. She went to the Prague when she was 21, met a French guy, and then spent most of her 20s in France, like hitchhiking. And she even did her master's in France on hitchhiking. And she was an expert on it. And me, I was kind of came late. Like, I started traveling a lot in my late 20s and early 30s. And it, I don't know, like, it was like a way to challenge myself in a way. Like, I often traveled alone, and I kind of like the idea of like waking up and like anything can happen, and what am I going to do today, and kind of, you know, I'll go here and here and here, and then what will be interesting is what happens on the way to those places. You know, I always try to walk or bike, you know, or take a local bus to get to anywhere, and just a boat, you know, whatever it takes. And then on the way usually is when I kind of developed an aesthetic of like taking pictures. That was like the accidental evolution for me into photography, because my background is in writing, actually.
So when the photography and the travel started, do you remember when, or it just happened naturally?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a moment in 2009. I started shooting with a Nikon F camera with a 35 millimeter 1.4 lens, and I started shooting with cross processing the photos.
Okay.
And I went to India for a month. That was like my fourth trip to India, and I spent most of the time in the Himalayas, and I came back, and the negatives looked really interesting. And from then on, I also around that same time, about a year earlier, I started shooting with a toy camera, a Diana F.
Plus,
which is one of my, so between like those kind of cross process and the toy cameras, it's kind of a surreal kind of mix of images. That was like a starting point. And then in 2013, I started darkroom printing. And then that's when I really began to, I feel like, develop my own signature as an artist or as a photographer. And that's also around the time I just started devoting most of my energy into photography instead of writing, because I had to make a choice. There was only so much time. Making a print can take several hours. There are a lot of photos to print, and experimenting, you know, can take a lot of time, and it takes a lot of, I think, it just takes some mental energy and imagination to, okay, what am I doing with these pictures? Like, what kind of story can I tell? What do they say about me? Where do I go from here? And, you know, if I were just trying to make up stories and short fiction, or rewrite my two novels, or try to come up with a new novel, it would just take so much of that kind of inspiration away from photography. I mean, I would like to get back into writing, and I still write, but my main focus is on photography, and I actually see the two mediums kind of fusing together. My first book is all pictures. I didn't want anyone to. Sunlanders is my first book.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah. I've seen it online, but I'm planning to order from you, actually.
So Sunlanders is all like prints. There's no text because I wanted, it's my first book. I didn't want to put any ideas into the consumer, the readers. Yeah. I consider it reader. Like people looking at photo books, I feel like it's reading. You're reading with your visual literacy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then my second book, which maybe is in Tokyo bookstores because it was published in Tokyo as well. Middle Life Notes. I don't know.
Okay, the one you have haiku, poem and photos. Yeah.
So that one is, it's an essay and 12. They're mostly waka, which are like a little bit longer than haiku. 5-7-5.
Okay.
7-7. Yeah, but yeah, and it's kind of autobiographical. And then the one I'm doing about my my wife, actually, the one I'm printing in Tokyo, is a long essay with photography. And then the one I'm doing in Paris is it's kind of like Middle Life Notes. It's called The Sniper Paused So He Could Wipe His Brow.
Oh yeah, I love the title.
I do too. It's kind of it's excerpted from one of the poems, but it's kind of an intense title, but I know I would pick up that book, you know, if I'm like...
Yeah, it's interesting because as soon as I read the title, I had an image. I had an image that someone was alive because of the sniper's scratch eyebrow. So it's kind of, I saw the hopeful message in that title. I don't know, that is your intention or not.
The full haiku is the sniper pause. Just the piper paused so he could wipe his brow and have a sip of water.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's a photograph from Aswan, Egypt, kind of a surreal double exposure of like a woman on the street. And that's all like Diana Twickhammer prints with haiku. And that one is, whereas Middle Life Notes is all Japan and an autobiographical waka poems. Mm-hmm. Sniper is from like 20 different countries over 15 years of using the Diana. And I would say that the poems are more like micro stories. Like they're obeying the 5-7-5 haiku structure, but whereas haiku are often about, you know, nature or, you know, the time passing. These are more kind of structured to tell like a story. Some of them are a little bit like kind of sarcastic, like the title of the, you know, poem, you know? So, yeah. So, and then I've got other projects I've been working on. And I think, you know, I really like the idea of combining text.
Yeah,
and,
I think it's really interesting.
But as long as one doesn't, you know, I think they have to respect each other. I feel like the pictures and text, neither should kind of, I mean, the text should not interrupt the photography. The photography needs to be paramount because it's a photo book still, right? Yeah. The text is supplementary, more than complementary, I think. It's hard to say, you know, it's nuanced. But, you know, photography is paramount. And I'm a photographer more than anything, so I that's how I self-identify at this point in my life.
Yeah, so. Definitely you are.
Yeah.
No, I mean, and the question now that comes to my mind is like, when you decide to embrace a new project, like you plan before, or like you go through your archives and you think, maybe there's a story here.
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, a lot of it is going through my contact sheets. And I look for patterns in the images and see, okay, what am I kind of subconsciously photographing? And what this and this and this, what do they, these look like interesting if they, I put them together. Sometimes I get these, you know, like satori epiphanies, like, oh, what if I, you know, work on this? And I have these like smaller projects that are more thematic, like visually thematic that I'm doing that I'm not, you know, that are actually quite different from my my aesthetic that, mm-hmm. that people know me for, that I'm shooting with. I only shoot film. I really don't know how to use a digital camera or Photoshop mm-hmm. very well. Mm-hmm. I get these assignments sometimes, and it's always a little bit nervous in the beginning. Okay, like which button is the ISO? Yeah, okay, just a second. You show me. Okay, yeah, and so these smaller projects, you know, but they're really fun too, and you know, I think it's like it's good for an artist to get out of what they're known for, you know, kind of break the expectation. I mean, I think it's good that artists will always kind of fulfill that expectation, you know, of a certain satisfaction of looking at the work. But I think like what you expect from the artist, like visually can, or, you know, like for example, to go to a different art form, like, you know, the way, you know, like someone like Bob, you know, in the 60s, like guys like Bob Dylan or the Beatles or the Beach Boys, or even in your Italy, is it Franco Battiato, right?
Yeah.
He would kind of experiment with like different forms. He would do these cover songs of like the Doors that sounded kind of strange. You know, like you don't want to just kind of do the same thing, I think, because otherwise you're going to burn out too if you're, you know, photographing like your same aesthetic all the time.
Yeah,
you know?
I think so. And I don't know. I understand it's a safe path, but many times I'm thinking like I'm the one hit singer. I will sing that song for 40 years. I want to fucking kill myself because it's like I'm not going anywhere. I'm stuck in time forever.
I think Mick Jagger needs those concert tickets to be $1,000 a ticket because he doesn't want to sing, because he needs that much money to sing Satisfaction for like the 10 millionth time. There's a Rolling Stone, I remember reading a Rolling Stone interview with Mick Jagger that was published in the 70s, and when he was like 30, and they asked him, well, do you see yourself singing Satisfaction when you're 40 or 50? He's like, no way. No way, mate. But he, you know, he's doing it because that's what the crowd wants to hear. Yes. You know, that's why they're paying all that big money to hear Satisfaction and the other big hits. So, but like, for example, like right now, I got a dog recently.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to walk him a couple hours a day. And so, you know, I'm just going around the neighborhood and I'm bringing my Nikon with me. And I'm just walking along a lot of the blocks. I'm walking along the same time. I mean, the same blocks over and over. And I've started to really see the streetscapes. Whereas before, you know, I was in a hurry. I was cycling.
Yeah.
I was not really paying attention, but you know, a dog is like sniffing everything, you know, it's like, this is his high for the day. You know, he's eating and walking around and sniffing everything outside. You know, it's just his like meaning of life. So I try to let him indulge, you know, walk slowly with him. But I've noticed like patterns in the streets, and like, you know, Kyoto is so famous for these blockbuster temples that we were speaking about. And, but it's not the real Kyoto, you know, real Kyoto for like the million people that live in the city is much more ordinary and everyday. And so I'm photographing these facades, street facades, like around the downtown area where I walk, and like, with really good light. And it's like there's no people in the pictures, and I'm just photographing the patterns. It's very quiet work compared to what I normally do, but I'm really feeling excited about it. It's fun. I'm, you know, like my rolls that I'm shooting, and I'm shooting with normal film, you know, very. So, but they're really kind of nice pictures, and I'm having a lot of fun with this. So I just want to do this where, you know, while I cannot travel, and I don't like shooting people with masks because it's it's like, you know, probably they don't want a person getting right up there and taking a picture right now, and I feel like it kind of signifies so much of this era that we're living in, an era I think a lot of people will want to move on from and forget, you know, when the roaring 20s start.
yeah, I hope so.
I hope so too.
It's what I keep telling everyone. It's like when the Second World War finished, everyone was like, yeah, let's live the life. So I hope is what it's going to happen to us soon.
I think so. I've been reading some really positive articles that make me feel better about, like, you know, how there's going to be this collective sigh of relief when we're able to kind of move on and take off our masks and, like, you know, enjoy a lunch with inside a restaurant with friends and not worry about, hey, is this right or wrong, or I shouldn't be here. You know, it's going to feel great going to a live show. Like, people are going to go to live shows all the time now, you know, because they're not going to say no to a concert, because, you know, now we know that, like, we can lose this again. Like, everything is more precious to us, our time, our money, our, you know, our opportunities, right?
I don't know about you, but I think about everyone this happened, that my perspective shifted so much. And, like, I'm consuming so... I'm buying so less stuff. I know it's not good for the economy. But, like, my priority really shifted. So I want to take care of myself, my mental health. So... Yeah.
How are you doing that with taking care?
It was tough at the beginning, because, like, when the pandemic hit, well, I lost all my work. Like... instantly.
Yeah, same here.
And until 5 months later, then I start to work again.
Yeah,
that 5 months was tough. Like, your design, I lost my sleep.
Design work and stuff.
I do projection mapping, so I work with video mostly.
Yeah.
It was hell.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
but, like, cooking, and also I take photographs, so I try, when there's less people, just walk around. So that helped me a lot.
And you started the zine too around the summer, right?
Yeah. I already started
before. Because I remember I was doing the thing with Alberto right when the thing started. Okay, so you started last year.
Right, because actually I delayed the printing of your zine because of the pandemic.
Yeah, I couldn't mail anything to the States.
Yeah,
that was frustrating. So I'm glad that, you know, for you, like, you had a turnaround in the summer, and you didn't go completely crazy.
No, almost. Just to remind everyone, addresses. So, Alberto Ferrero, you can find at albertoferrero.da, like Deutschland, and on Instagram, Alberto Ferrero. Sean Lottman, you can find his website, seanlottman.com, or also on Instagram, Sean Lottman. And Zero Feedback, you can find at zerofeedback.com without the vowels. So ZRFDBCK.com or Zero Feedback without the vowels on Instagram. Thank you again for listening, and I guess I'll see you next month for next episode. Bye-bye.